My name's Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself, because it's 1 o'clock on a Saturday.
Saturday, yes.
I haven't had anything to drink yet today, and haven't sniffed any glue or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. And this is?
I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
It's not my birthday.
Yes. Oh. And Bill and I have the good fortune to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of different areas, and we get to meet a lot of different people, and we get to hear a lot of different things. And as you go around the country, there are people who are saying that the Alcoholics Anonymous is in danger, that it's lost its edge, and the like. And so what... there's lots of things about, you know, recovery rates and all this. And so Bill and I got together and we thought about what could we do that could be a positive contribution. And so we came up with this talk that we like to call, Has AA Lost Its Edge? Look. Has technology lost its edge? I may have to stand over here. Huh. So... one of our favorite quotes. Nothing's more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory. This is hilarious. Mr. Cleveland?
Scott Peck, a non-alcoholic who never could quite stop smoking, so... anytime he'd talk about addiction, he'd always make the qualification that he was unable to control his own, so whatever he said was BS. He said, the greatest positive event of the 20th century occurred in Akron, Ohio on June 10th, 1935. There are people that say that Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. Beyond our own personal recovery, that it has changed the face of the planet. That some even say that it's raised the consciousness. David Hawkins, in his book Power Versus Force, said that it is the single most significant positive event of the 20th century. So I think what you and I are involved in is something that's way beyond our own personal recovery or addressing our own personal character defects. There's something that's happening that's much deeper and more profound than that. Now, some of you have heard Jay do his thing, his history stuff. We've done a lot of history stuff over the years, and where Alcoholics Anonymous came is from a group called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group had an ethic of sponsorship. They talked about one alcoholic working with another, or one person testifying to another. And this carried forth into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when Bill and Bob and the boys wrote the big book, when it came out in 1939, there was a lot of controversy about what to put in the book. You know, they say that it was the first 100 alcoholics. Well, there were only 77. You know, so they lied to us up front. You know. Jay did a really wonderful presentation yesterday morning, and the whole, or not Jay, but our friend Gail, Hank Parkhurst and Bill Wilson were a real pair. And these were a couple of salesmen, a couple of hucksters, a couple of promoters. And they had a good thing here, and they wanted to try to promote this. So the big book, as we understand it, was their promotional tool. It was a marketing tool. They took out the I and the you and you should and the rules, and they put in suggestions, and they softened it, and they said we. You know, if you've ever read one of the first lithographs of Chapter 5, you know, it's like, you know, if you don't want this thing, throw the book away. They took all that stuff out, you know. And they softened it, and they sent that out into the society. And from that, our fellowship has grown. Well, around that same time, in 1940, 1941, Bob Smith in Akron, Sweet Bob, Keep It Simple Bob, and some of his boys came up with this thing called the Akron Manual. And I think it more exemplifies what they were actually doing. So if you talk about wanting to take Alcoholics Anonymous back to the good old days, where they had this supposed 75% success rate, here's a good example of what they were really doing, what they really thought, what they really felt. And we're not promoting this as that we should go back to this, but it is a very interesting document, so I'll take you through a couple of little excerpts from it. Explain that we are not in the business of sobering up drunks merely to have them go on another bender. Explain that our aim is total and permanent sobriety. Not one time does this thing say anything, even allude to one day at a time. They didn't use that term. Definition of an Alcoholic Anonymous. An Alcoholic Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application of and adherence to the rules laid down by the organization, has completely forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages. The moment he wittingly drinks so much as a drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic drink, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're out. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain completely sober for all time. Loser, get out. Just a minute here. To the newcomer. Just a minute here. Oh, I've lost it. If you are not ready to part with alcohol forever, it would be better for all concerned if you discontinued reading this and give up the idea of becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Get with the program. Here we go. I screwed this up. A word to the sponsor. You must fulfill all pledges you make to him, either tangible or intangible. If you cannot fulfill a promise, do not make it. You have in your hands the most valuable property in the world, the future of a fellow man. Treat his life as carefully as you would your own. You are literally responsible for his life. That kind of puts a whole new perspective on it, doesn't it? Alcoholics Anonymous is 100% effective for those who faithfully follow the rules. It is those who try to cut corners who find themselves back in their old drunken state. Okay. There is no satisfaction in the world like watching the progress of a new Alcoholics Anonymous. No whiskey in the world can give you that thrill. Yeah. Yeah. You will be tireless in your efforts to help others. It is a splendid enthusiasm. Cherish it for as long as you can. Here's one of the ones that I really like. You aren't very important in this world. If you lose your job, someone better will replace you. If you die, your wife will mourn briefly and then remarry. Your children will grow up and you will be but a memory. In the last analysis, you are the only one who benefits by your sobriety. Seek to cultivate humility. Remember that cockiness leads to a speedy fall. So you can see they were having problems, you know. Let's see. I'm just going to skip through this. Don't criticize the methods of others. Strangely enough, you may change your own ideas as you become older in sobriety. Remember, there are a dozen roads from New York to Chicago, but they all land in Chicago. At meetings, don't criticize the leader. He has his own problems. Already, there was enough bitching going on where they actually wrote this down. Like, come on, man, back off. He has his own problems, as doing his best to solve them. Help him along by standing up and saying a few words. He will appreciate your kindness and thoughtfulness. How soon you will be cured of a desire to drink is another matter. That depends entirely upon how quickly you can succeed in changing your fundamental outlook on life. For as your outlook changes for the better, desire will become less pronounced until it disappears almost entirely. It may be weeks, it may be months. Your sincerity and your capacity for working with others on the AA program will determine the length of time. There's one other thing here. Alcoholics Anonymous is based on a set of laws known as the 12 steps. Laws. Years of experience have definitely proved that those who live up to these rules remain sober. Those who gloss over or ignore any one rule are in constant danger of returning to a life of drunkenness. Thousands of words can be written on each rule. Lack of space prevents, so they are merely listed here. It is suggested that they be explained by the sponsor. If he cannot explain them, he should provide someone who can. So that's a little excerpt from the Akron Manual. So this is what the boys, you have to remember that when the Wright brothers did two things. They invented the airplane. They invented flight, powered flight. The second thing that they did is they invented how to fly the damn thing. And what was happening to them is when they, every time they would turn, they would lose lift and the plane would crash. They didn't know about flaps. This, to me, is the flying blind, that period where these guys were trying to figure out how to disseminate this information. Now there were people starting to come in, and they're trying to figure out, how do we do this? Well, we'll talk a little further about that, about screening them before you let them in to make sure you only get good ones.
This is Tom Key. Bill, he was Bill's editor. Is the mic working? Mic went off. Mic on? On. On.
Hello? Okay, yeah. Great. This is Tom P. was Bill's editor for the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. He also edited the stories in the second edition of the Big Book. He wrote a lot of things for the Grapevine. One of the interesting things about Tom is that Tom had an experience very much like Bill's, a white light experience. The only difficulty was he called his psychologist, who immediately had him taken to the nut house and medicated. And he was kept there for a couple of years while they worked on him. What would have happened to us if Silkworth hadn't have read The Varieties of Religious Experience? So anyway, I had the good fortune to go out to High Ridge, New York to visit him and this great experiment that he and his son, Tom P. Jr., did. They have a commune, and they did all the stuff that you'd do if you could redo the program. In 1965, 66, 67, they're having everybody do yoga. They're having them do later on, profound, detailed sexual inventories. They're getting everybody off sugar and white flour. Later on, meat. I mean, they're just, this is the way we're going. We're going to do things correctly. And they had books that you had to read. I've actually got thing on the greatest books, religious books of the world, which you had to, if you were going to be sober, you had to read all this stuff, you know, and it had the Bible and this and that. Later, but it's funny, they started editing things when people aren't spiritually correct, like after 1970, all of Islam is for some reason removed. But anyway, Tom Sun wrote this, Gresham's Law in Alcoholics Anonymous. Gresham's Law is an economic theory that says that if you've got two currencies and they're valued the same, in other words, when I pay for the bread, the guy's going to take it, but one isn't backed by the same solid currency or the same solid, that the one that isn't solid is going to end up taking over. The thing that isn't as solid is going to end up taking over. So bad currency tends to drive out good. And that this has been operative in Alcoholics Anonymous, that weak AA is tending to drive out the strong. And so they talk about these three ways of working the steps. There's the strong, original way, proved powerfully and reliably effective for over 70 years. There's the medium way, not so strong, not so safe, not so sure, not so good, but it's still effective. And then there's the weak way, which is no way at all, but literally a false teaching. It is a corruption of the stated program. And I've been with you since the second day of May in 1979 and consecutively sober that entire time, and I hate to tell you, but there's been times that I've worked the program each of these ways. I know nobody here has had that problem, but I'm just...
I certainly haven't.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So what's strong AA? Just so we can define the terms. Well, strong AA is you do all 12 steps and keep on taking them. That you practice rigorous honesty. You take and continue to make restitution. That you admit faults. That you pray and meditate daily. And that you go to two or more AA meetings weekly and actively work the 12 steps. Now, one of the things that I enjoy about this is it doesn't say that all your problems are solved. Looks like you still can get in trouble and the like, but that you are able to get out of it and you don't have to live in your problems. Medium AA starts off with a bang. Stay sober. Procrastinates on parts they don't like. You know how it is. Some people don't like the God steps. Don't talk to me about that. Or the inventory steps. Who really needs to do that? I've got God. They go to a meeting a week. They don't have much self-examination. They don't have any effective sponsorship, but you know they're like secretary of the meeting, or they got a commitment, you know. So I'm in the group, you know, kind of like joining the Elks Club, except this particular Elks Club doesn't drink. And then there's the weak AA. Unlike medium, big chunks have left out of the programs. They go to lots of meetings, and they stay away from the first drink. Now it's one of the fascinating things about this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing that was, you know, came out in like 1936, is that these people had absolutely no idea that you could stay sober without doing all this stuff. And yet we found that just the spiritual power of the movement can help people not drink that are just going around and hanging out around us, just agreeing with us, not doing anything. And the early members would say, it's impossible. But yet it is. I mean, you see it all the time. I've actually sponsored people that say, oh, you don't have to do the steps, not when I'm in the room. But they aren't doing them, and they'll tell people, oh, you don't have to do that stuff, because they've never done it. But of course, their lives never change. And of course, that's what we're talking about, is this change that's available to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's just kind of fun to have a little definition about that, you know, and that what is it that that we're doing when we come to these meetings. What is it that we're involved in? Is it strong AA? I mean, are we actually doing the stuff? And if we're not running around to each other and going, meathead, you got to get with it. No, it's just, oh, yeah, I was there too. Come on. Along. You don't have to be like that anymore. You don't have to suffer. I mean, we're in an AA meeting, and there are, you know, in all the people that are in this room, there are people that are suffering today from things that may not be from the front drink. But it may be some other things in their lives that they wish weren't true. I know I've been that person. And yet all I had to do was step into this process, be guided along, or run into some people that maybe had some experience using these, maybe using a couple different words on it, and it's been able to relieve the suffering that I've placed myself in. Mr. Cleveland?
So where's the message? You know, one of the things that you hear these people talk about, that AA has lost its edge, they talk about that the message isn't here anymore. The message has been diluted. And what they're talking about is when you go to meetings, you don't hear the message. So where's the message? Is it in the meetings? Is it in service? Is it in the book? Is it in meditation? Or is it at the kitchen table? Now, what you hear is that the meetings have to be controlled. The meetings have to be run correctly. We have to stop chanting. Chanting is killing AA. It is creeping in and destroying it. We stop chanting. We only read the black parts of the book. It's all in the book. We don't give opinions. We don't give advice. If we didn't give opinions and give advice, we wouldn't have anything to say to each other, you know? I mean, but you hear all this really hard right-wing fundamentalist kind of talk. And, you know, there's meetings that only certain people go to of the same age group, you know, and they all hide out together because over there at the Alano Club, there's just weakness there. It's a slippery place. There's no message. Now, this tells me, if you believe this, if you fall into this, which many of us have, which I have, I've gone through this period, that the message is in the meeting. I don't think so. I think the meetings reflect the culture of an AA community in a given area. If there's message going on in the recovery process, then the meetings will reflect that. I think a lot of this comes from people that believe that going to lots of meetings is doing AA. And there's a lot of people like that, that just go to lots of meetings. And if they're going, all they're doing is going to meetings, then they need to have the message in the meetings. One of the things that you'll hear is, I went to a meeting and it was horrible. It was horrible. People sat around and just talked about how their day went. I didn't hear anything about the steps. I didn't hear anything about God. It was like a support group. It was like therapy. My God, it was just horrible. I ran out of there with my hair on fire, screaming down the street, you know? Well, my experience with that over the years is, I think that the people that go to meetings and share about how their day went don't have a sponsor. And if they do, they're not communicating with the sponsor. They're not talking about what's going on. They're definitely not sponsoring anybody. Because if they were sponsoring people, they would be in the process all the time. Unless they're sponsoring people on a level where they say, go ahead, read the book. If you have a problem, give me a call. But if they're sitting down across from the kitchen table and they're reading the book with them, they're in the inventory process all the time. There's constant introspection. And there's a difference between self-obsession and self-awareness when you're involved with other people. But these people that are going to meetings, and year after year after year after year, you hear them talking about what is happening in their life. It's the only outlet they have for that. It's not, to me, it's kind of a sad thing. It's a lonely thing. If the only place I have to go is to AA, and in order for me to get what I think I need, I have to turn it into a therapeutic situation where I'm going to dump my problem in there, and then I'll find somebody that has a similar problem, and we can commiserate with each other. That's not in the solution. But I think the key here, and what we're driving at, is the whole idea of working with others, that there's a difference between activity and action. In the whole service thing, you know, the medium AA, one of the things that you'll see people do, and I've been around long enough where I've had people come and ask me for help. And these are people that are secretaries of meetings. They're people that are involved in AA at different levels. They're GSRs and they're CSRs. And they're miserable. They're miserable. And somebody will walk up and say, I need some help. Will you help me work the steps? And I'll look at them and say, well, haven't you done this? Haven't you worked the steps? And they'll look at me and they'll say, well, yeah, but not like what you're talking about. I haven't done that. I haven't really made the amends. I'm not sponsoring anybody. And I'm 9 years sober and I'm on the way out. This is boring. I've lost interest in this. You know. So where the message is, and what we're the point that we're trying to make with this, we believe that the message is at the kitchen table. That's where the real message of recovery is. That's where I got my message of recovery. When I sat there and I read the book with this other man, and we went through the book, and we went through the process of the inventory process, and doing the third step together, making a list of amends, and going about the process of making those amends. And if you've got a home group that really believes in that, that believes in that ethic, then usually when you go to that home group, that's what gets talked about, because that's what's happening in our lives.
Now, another thing that is bandied about a lot is this idea that somehow we've lost our effectiveness, that AA is not as effective as it used to be. Now, it's really fun because I'm a history geek that years ago, when I first came into AA, I got a copy of Ernest Kurtz's book, Not God. And it's a wonderful thing if you want to sit down and read somebody's doctoral thesis. Much better to read AA Comes of Age, but specifically Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and Pass It On. Because, you know, before you go running out to try and find some way to figure out what it is that AA has lost, it's pretty good to find out what it is that we think we are as a movement. So read the conference-approved literature first. But there are people that say that, you know, there's only 5% of the people that are that come to AA that are staying sober. And that's like saying that only 5% of the people that come to a car lot buy a car. You know, I mean, what is it that we're talking about here? When I first got into this history stuff, I was trying to find out what it was that we'd lost, how we'd lost our effectiveness. And as I started to study it, I found out that there isn't anything that's been lost. So this thing that there's a 5 or 10% in the foreword to the second edition, it says that of the people who come to AA and really try, 50% of them stop drinking at once, and another 25% after drinking a little bit, they actually stay and they don't drink again. And then the next 25% show general improvement. By 1980, I was afraid of people who drank and that kept coming to meetings. Nowadays, I'm just delighted to watch their general improvement, because they're getting better. You know, they're improving. They may not be staying sober but they're not living in the same kind of pain they were. So, just for fun, in 1938, Frank Amos, who worked for Mr. Rockefeller, needed some numbers to come to show Mr. Rockefeller about why he should give some money to Alcoholics Anonymous. So the boys sat down and, okay, how many do we really have that are sober? Well, we got 100. Well, of the 100, 41 were definitely on the ball. They weren't drinking. Six were questionable. We see a few questionable people around the roundup this weekend, but 12, Mr. Cleveland, when I met him, was definitely in this. Too difficult. We had to almost practically deny that he was involved. 10, they're definitely in, but they're out of touch. We just can't seem to find them. We know they're doing all right, but we just can't. And the other 25, we've got prospects. We've got prospects. Okay, that's 1938. This is when we're, you know, supposed to be having this highly effective. Now, Jim Burwell, the guy who is credited with the God as you understand God line in the big book, he went down to Philadelphia and started AA there. Wonderful guy. He lived in, I think he passed away in like 1980 or something. I mean, he lived a long time, sober a long time. Ended up down in San Diego. Great guy. And he sat down and wrote down a list of everybody that had something to do with the big book. Okay? And he said of that, there were 48 men and one woman that were active and contributed to the big book. Of the 49, there were 11 of them that stayed sober continuously. 11. And the rest, the other 38, drank at least one more time before they quit. But, you know, they picked up. In 1941, Jack Alexander writes the article in the Saturday Evening Post, and I know that you guys all go to meetings that have literature racks because that's proper AA. You have to have a literature rack. If you haven't picked up the Jack Alexander article, please do. Just, you know, stick it in your pocket sometime and read it, because it's really, really exciting, and it is what made our movement. Without that piece of information, AA never would have survived. Anyway, in it, they were talking about the effective. AA claimed, he said, that they were 100% effective with non-psychotic drinkers. Mr. Cleveland, yeah. Who sincerely want to quit. Sincerely want to quit. The program will not work, they add, will not work with those who only want to quit, or those who want to quit because they're afraid of losing their families or jobs. Now, that's what the movement said about itself, that if you're here because you're going to lose your job or your family, cool, but that's not what's going to get you sober and keep you sober on an all-time basis. So in 44, and this is a thing that just rocked me, because again, I'd been trying to look for these things that so I could teach more effectively and be a better AA member and all this stuff, and find those things back in the deep history of AA that was going to work. But what's back there in this deep history that people say we've got to go back to? Well, year number one, 5, sober, 5. Second year, 15. Third year, 40. That's by the time we get to Mr. Rockefeller. At the end of the fourth year, there's 100 people. Now they decided they actually get the book going. While they're doing that, 400 people. Fifth year. And then what happens? Alexander writes the article in the Liberty Magazine, the Saturday Evening Post article come out, and it's in everybody's home in America. And what happens? Boom, 2,000. And then 8,000. It wasn't the fact that it was this little Christian movement doing things properly. It was the fact that the message got out that people could recover if they did this process. And if you haven't heard, you know, if you haven't had the pleasure, because there's a lot of folks here that never got exposed to this guy, Chuck C., that you hear a lot of us talk about. He just died, 25 years ago. Over here at Encore Tapes, they've got some Chuck C. talks. And he actually talks about his wife, Elsa, who shared at this roundup 25 years ago, having that magazine and knowing exactly where it was so that when he hit bottom that last time, he knew where to go because he'd read that article in the Saturday Evening Post. So what's the price of this old-time success? You'll hear that back in Cleveland in 1940, 1939, they had a 90% success rate. Well, how did they do that? How did they go about doing it? Well, this is what Clarence and the boys were doing. They wouldn't let you just go to a meeting by one guy talking to you, as they do now. They felt you should know something about where you were going and what you were going to hear. And that Clarence made me go to the home of a new member every night for 3 months and had 9 or 10 people talking to us. So in order to even go to a meeting, you had to go to people's house for months. And you had to read the book all the way through before you went to the meeting. And I'm not even counting you as a prospect yet until you've done all this stuff. Now, Clarence wrote a letter to Bill talking about what we were doing in 1940, and he said that several groups do not permit a rummy to attend unless he has been hospitalized or at least talked to by 10 men. And that most groups required either hospitalization, being talked to by at least 5 members, or my personal favorite, being passed by a committee before the new person could attend meetings. We've got to find out what Bingham's true character really is before we're going to let him in. So, I mean, when we talk about, this fabulous success rate, well, you know, if you had to let Bill and I and the boys take a look at you before we let you in, I'm sure we'd be correctly sober, too, in our meeting. Now, another one of these sainted people in the past is Sister Ignatia. You know, and she did. She was wonderful, and there's a wonderful biography if you can get. But I mean, she was hard as nails. After Bob dies, she takes over at St. Thomas Hospital, and she insists that an Akron AA member in good standing, by the way, had to sponsor anybody that was sent to the hospital. In addition to making sure that this guy has AA visitors, all right. The sponsor also has to pay the newcomer's hospital expenses if he runs out the door or he doesn't cover his own bill. So you can imagine that people were a little more attentive about who they were taking to the hospital in those days, right? And so what happened to the problem drinkers? Well, the angel to alcoholics, Sister Ignatia, normally allowed people only one chance to go through the hospital treatment. On rare occasions, she'd let a person come back for a second try, but the patient would be completely isolated from other incoming alcoholics, so not to tear down morale. No one at all got a third chance. So, I mean, when you're talking about the numbers, let's define what the terms really are, you know? So, Bill?
One of the other things that you hear about is that AA has stopped growing. That every 4 years, I believe it is, GSO comes out with a census, and they send out census forms, and different groups will fill these out, and they compile the census, and they extrapolate it, and they come up with an estimated membership and an estimated number of groups throughout the world. Now, I've got a sign-up sheet here, and you know, if you'd like to get a copy of the Akron Manual and some of this other stuff that we're using, give me your email address, and I'd be happy to email it to you. And for the tape, if anybody gets this tape, it's billc@kitchentableaa.com. So if you'd like to get copies, and we're not going to try and go through all the statistics, but when you look at how that this is compiled, they say that we have approximately 2 million members, and there's 160,000 meetings, something like that. And that has flattened out over the last few censuses. They change the way they compile the censuses. They only count the number of meetings that are registered with New York.
As groups.
You know, as groups, not as individual meetings, as groups. 20% of the population of AA, they estimate, is in California. California has very few groups. There's just nothing but a bunch of meetings. So the bulk of the meetings in California are not in that list. In California. And there's 3,500 meetings a week in the LA basin alone. You know, so they have no idea what the membership of AA is or how many groups there are. I mean, literally no idea. They could be off by 50% or maybe even 100%. But what's used is that we've flattened out. Because the message has been diluted, we're not growing anymore. You have to count the other 12-step programs that have spun off of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to talk about recovery, there's 300 at least 12-step programs that have spun off from Alcoholics Anonymous. If you look at some of the big ones, you look at Cocaine Anonymous, you look at the membership of Cocaine Anonymous, you look at the membership of Narcotics Anonymous, you'd have to look at the membership of all these other programs to really determine where the growth is. And one of the things that we talk about in AA a lot is singleness of purpose. I think it's an important concept in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of people are coming in and are saying, well, what's the big deal about singleness of purpose? Well, it's identification. And the way Alcoholics Anonymous has dealt with singleness of purpose is that you have another problem besides alcohol, we will help you start your own organization. We'll give you the book. We'll give you the steps. We'll even show up to the meetings. We'll help you structure this. You heard there's a man around that speaks a lot, Tom Ivester. He's 50 years sober. He's just a great guy. And he's from North Carolina. And he had, his home group is like a regional meeting, you know, out in the country somewhere. It's a small part of the country. And there was a recovery place had formed. And they were dumping off all these kids in the meeting, and they're all junkies and tweakers and stuff, you know, and all the old guard in this meeting out in the outback are all upset with these drug addicts coming into our AA meeting. And Jay and I were at a history conference, and Tom gave a talk on the traditions. And we thought, boy, this guy, he's going to have a hard-ass, like, right-wing approach, you know. So they had a steering committee meeting in his meeting. And him and a bunch of other guys found a place, they rented it, and they started an NA meeting. These old alcoholics started an NA meeting. And they took the kids over to the NA meeting, and they went to it for over a year to make sure that it got off the ground, that it was managed well. And I looked at Jay, and I said, it can't be that simple. I mean, Jesus, there's got to be, like, dead bodies and stuff and letters to New York about this thing, you know, and a lot of bitching and complaining at the local district level. No, they started an NA meeting and took the kids over there. Now they're, and it's at the same time and the same night of the week. It's like, here, take them over there. Dump the dope fiends off over there. You know, we'll help them get started. So if you look at the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous, as the demographics has changed, as the people who come into AA have changed, so has been the growth of these 12-step programs.
And the amount of, the other thing that's fun is that, you know, it used to be that back in the late 80s, people would come around to AA meetings and they'd say, I'm coming to AA, I'm a cocaine addict, but there's no recovery there. But if you go to the meetings now, there's recovery there. The program has worked. You know, it's had time to get the traction. Things are moving. The spirit is moving. And we have to say, or I believe that we need to acknowledge the fact that all these other groups are doing it, and we need to, you know, support and recognize that this is how consciousness is moving through our society. Now, another great thing is I know you can't believe this, but in Islam, like, you're not supposed to drink at all. Drinking, bad. In fact, in some places, it's a fatal problem, okay? And in Iran, though, you can be a drug addict. So what happens? The alcoholics are all hiding out in NA, because you can have NA meetings, but you can't have AA meetings. And so there was a convention that they had in 2006 in Tehran, 12,000 people recovering, working the program. unbelievable.
Showed up to the convention.
Yeah, that's the convention.
Tehran. We don't have a convention that big in the United States. Do you suppose there's alcoholics hiding out in the NA convention there in Tehran?
And so take, and then our friends in Narcotics Anonymous. If you start to go out outside the United States, Narcotics Anonymous is really big, really violent, vibrant. So is CA. There's a lot of step working people that are carrying the message and doing fun. In 78, there's fewer than 200 registered groups in three countries. By 83, they've got more than a dozen countries and almost 3,000 meetings. By 93, there are 60 countries that Narcotics Anonymous is in, and over 19,000 meetings. By 2007, there's 25,000 groups, almost 44,000 meetings a week around the planet. The spirit is moving.
So David Hawkins, in his book Power Versus Force, one of the things he says when it's the single most significant social movement is the numbers he uses is that he figures in North America, just in North America alone, AA has touched the lives of 50% of the population of Canada, the United States, and in that area. 50% of the population. And the way you look at that is you look at AA, Al-Anon, NA, Narcanon, CA, Koanon. You go down the list, the spinoffs that's come. That's 300 million people. 300 million people in North America. If he's even close to that, it's the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. So is it growing? Is it vibrant and alive? Answer the question. I think it is. I think it is.
Now, one of the fun things we don't do, that when we started out doing this, we asked people to raise their hand for all the different programs that they qualified for, but we had some dislocated shoulders. So, but anyway, I mean, just enjoy this. I mean, here we got Cancer Anonymous. We got Christians in Recovery. We've got Clutterers Anonymous. Walking into my office is a slip. We've got Codependence of Sexual Addiction. Crystal Meth Anonymous, coming to a neighborhood near you. Debtors Anonymous, Dual Recovery Anonymous, Emotions Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous.
Well, when they came up with Codependence Anonymous, they finally found a program that absolutely every living human being qualifies for. Yeah.
And since I have 7 personalities, I can have a group in my own bathroom. Marijuana Anonymous, Narcanon, Nicotine Anonymous, Obsessive Compulsive Anonymous, OA. And one of the really interesting things about the way that the spirit moves is that the food programs and the sex programs seem to almost exponentially grow in their being different things. There's Overeaters Anonymous, Compulsive Eaters Anonymous, there's CA How, there's all these different food programs as people find out a way of recovering that works for them and they're able to share with each other, and it's fascinating. The same with the sexual recovery programs, because the definition of abstinence, different people are able to abstain using different rules, but always within the basis of the spirituality of the 12 steps.
Youth for Environmental Sanity. I bet you that's an uplifting group.
Yeah. I believe they're going to do a 12-step on reclaiming your mind. So what's really happened, okay? In 7 decades, we've got an estimated, the membership has grown from 2 members and 2 groups in the United States to almost 2 million members and over 100,000 groups internationally. That's just AA. This is not a measurement of something going wrong. And as Bill and I always like to say, that the heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous is working with others. I did my first inventory when I was 22 days sober. Was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory? Using all 4 columns. No, it was the greatest hits. But my sponsor came over the next day. I read the stuff to him. We did 6 and 7. We burned the inventory. Oh my God, how could you do that? It's your roadmap to recovery. The stuff was really fresh in my mind. We wrote an 8-step list. By the time I'm not even 4 weeks sober, I'm out making amends. When I was 28 days sober, a guy asked me to sponsor him because I was well in the process, you know? And I called my sponsor up and I said, well, what do I do? And he says, Jay, if they're sick enough to ask you for help, you cannot hurt them. Exhibit B.
You know, one of the things when we do the sponsorship workshop, we ask people, you know, should everybody sponsor? We'll ask the group, should everybody sponsor? And ask people what they think about that. And invariably, somebody will say, no, man, some people would be rotten sponsors. Some people have no message to carry at all. Well, the answer to that is, how do I know that some guy doesn't need a shitty sponsor? How do I know? How do I know that that isn't what you might need? You know, I mean, there's a group of people in AA that I like to call parking lot people. They hang out in the parking lot, you know. They're drinking Red Bulls and smoking one cigarette after another, and they're not coming into the meetings. They're hanging out in the parking lot. Well, somebody would say, geez, you don't want one of these parking lot people sponsoring people. Well, I don't know that. I'm powerless. I'm not running the show here. Something else is running the show. How do I know that some guy walking up to a parking lot guy and say, will you be my sponsor, might force that guy into the meeting to pick up some information? You know, how do I know that isn't what he needs? When two people come together, not just one is helped. You know, sometimes what happens is I get a new guy and he'll come to me and say, somebody asked me to sponsor him. What do I do? And I said, stay ahead of him. You know, it's important. You stay ahead of him. You know, he says, well, Jesus, you know, so he starts reading the book, you know, with intent, you know, because he's got to come up with some BS to tell this other guy, you know, because we all know that what a sponsor does is direct another human being's life, right? I mean, that's what we think. And then when you get into the process, you realize that isn't what's going on at all. You know? But, you know, this whole idea of working with others is the mechanism that is used in this process to cause us to confront our defects of character. It is the mechanism that the manager uses to put us in uncomfortable positions where we confront ourselves. And if you want to work on your character defects, sponsor people. You'll run into every one of them. You know, you can't help me. I've sat in a room and given a guy a 20-minute lecture on how he should live his life. And then he leaves the room, and I think to myself, man, that's good shit. I should try some of that. You know? So what the hell's that? I think that's hypocrisy. You know? And I'm a liar. You know? But it's more subtle. It isn't as bad as it used to be when I was out in the street. But it's the same stuff now. You know, I mean, it's just, I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy, but I never went to the beach. You know, and I never... my motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me, but I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. You know? So in Alcoholics Anonymous, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what has changed? I'm 6, 7, 8 years sober, and I'm a phony guru. I'm president of AA. You know, here I am, I'm sponsoring half the South Bay, I'm speaking at meetings, and I'm just miserable. And I can't figure out why. What's wrong? What is wrong? Because the picture I'm painting of myself wasn't real. Now, I didn't know that. I couldn't see that. I couldn't see it. So at about 8 years sober, the sheer weight of my personality crushed me. I mean, carrying around this big ego it's difficult. You think I'm arrogant now? You should have seen me a few years ago. You know?
I had to wear mirrored sunglasses just to...
How else could I have confronted that if I wasn't interacting with other people? If I was just going to meetings and talking about what was going on in my life, none of that would happen. You are an integral part of my recovery. I can't recover without you. Now, one of the other things is the demographics in Alcoholics Anonymous has changed, hasn't it? I mean, back in the 30s and 40s, what these guys were doing was going into hospitals and bringing people out of hospitals. They would essentially go from bed to bed and say, are you willing to quit drinking forever? And when some guy would say yes, they would bring him into the meeting or bring him into this recovery process. If the other guy would argue or say no, they just didn't. Things have changed now, haven't they? Bill Wilson wanted hospitals across the country. He wanted Rockefeller to finance building hospitals across the country. And so that the federal government, the government would stop jailing alcoholics and put them into recovery. He wanted to build a business that would offer that service that did not exist in the United States. And Rockefeller turned him down, thank God. In the 60s, him and Marty Mann and a bunch of other people really went on this big campaign they called the Big 12 Step, where they went to Washington, D.C. They got the American Medical Association on their side to call it a disease. And they went to the government and they said, look, we want recovery. We don't want you to put us in hospitals anymore. We want recovery. And they lobbied for this. Chuck Chamberlain was part of it. It was a big movement. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985, that movement that they had initiated had worked. There were hospitals. Insurance companies were covering medical model 30-day hospitals for huge bucks. And most of us, probably I would think that most of us in this room that are of a certain age, have come through a recovery facility of some sort. We didn't just come in off the street. We weren't just in a hospital and some AA guy called on us. We came in through a recovery place. In 85, when I came in, there were people sitting in meetings bitching about the spin dries, complaining about the recovery industry, saying, well, they're making money off of us and all this stuff. And there was an adversarial relationship between AA and the recovery industry that I don't know has ever really healed. But his dream of wanting this to happen came true. It came true. Now, recovery is part of our lexicon. It covers all levels of our society. And the children are coming in now, you know? Have you noticed? And they refuse to leave. The children are here now. The kids. A few, our men's stag, the Hermosa Beach men's stag, the epicenter of sobriety, where you can truly hear the message in its correct form, you know, so that you can be sober correctly as compared to incorrectly sober. In that meeting, there's 100 to 110 guys. In the last 5, 6, 7 years, maybe, 50% of that room is under the age of 22 years old. 50% of the room. It's changed that dramatically in that period of time. A few years ago, this one kid was taking a cake for 1 year. And he's 15 years old, and he's taking this cake for 1 year. And he stands up at the head of the room, a little short guy. And he gave the most right-wing death squad AA pitch I have ever heard. And at the end of it, he's standing there, and he's got his finger going, and he's pointing at us. And he says, now, if you're sitting out there tonight, and you don't have a sponsor, and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul. And I walked up to him and asked him to be my sponsor. I mean, for weeks after that, we were walking around looking at each other going, may God have mercy on your soul.
So the thing that we're inviting you to do, we'd really like to invite you to do, this whole thing about AA lost its edge, really has to do with each and every one of us. What's happening when you're going to a meeting? Are you going there to meet your friends? Are you going there to hear what you want to hear? Are you going there for what it is that you can get? Or are you doing what's recommended, that when I get up in the morning that I open my heart and I ask to be useful, and that I go down to the meeting and see what showed up, and that I do not resist the change? You know, Bill talked about what was going on in 85, and you know, a lot of the old timers that I was emulating at that time were all screaming about, that happened on my watch. that happened on my watch. I'm responsible for what happened in that adversarial relationship. And it's my job to make sure that the kids and the people that are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous now, how do I make amends for that? That when I go to the meeting, my hand's open and my hand's out. You know, do I walk up and say, would you please take off your sunglasses? Of course I do. Somebody's got to do it. But I don't run them out anymore. And the thing is that the only way that AA is losing its edge is in our own home. Gordon, Bill's dad, said this. He died with 45 years of sobriety. His mother had 48 years in Al-Anon when she passed. And he said, each and every person in the room, there is one life that you are designed to save if you're in the fellowship. And if you are not at the meeting armed with the facts about what recovery is, what will happen when that person comes through the door? So you can't hurt them. You would never ever be able to do anything to an alcoholic or a compulsive overeater or any one tiny bit of the damage that they inflict upon themselves. So
and you know, it's not, recovery by its very nature is uncomfortable. I mean, when you and I come in here, you know, this is not a comfortable place to be. You've taken away my medication and I'm uncomfortable. I don't think that changes. I think as the years go by, if we're not a little bit uncomfortable, we're probably not doing much. And what I saw happen in my home group is when these kids started coming, a bunch of people left, and they would say things like, hey, we're not a daycare center here, you know, and stuff. And I'm looking at it going, God, that's ugly. You know, and there's people that are going off forming their own groups where they feel comfortable. And I don't think it's up to me to be comfortable. It's up to me to accept whatever's coming, whatever the manager is sending, whatever, have faith that this is not an accident, that this is not a mistake. It's supposed to be like this. Have faith that whatever's being sent to me is what I'm supposed to deal with, not what I choose to deal with. Don't ever leave it up to me with this finely tuned instrument to determine whether you're correctly alcoholic enough for me to work with. And I think when it gets like that, I think AA has lost its edge. But when we're an accepting, open place and you come and you ask me for help and I never, ever say no, ever, that's the Alcoholics Anonymous that I know and love.
We're going to end this by reading a little piece and then we'll take some questions if you want. But this was written by Samuel Moore Shoemaker.
This Shoemaker was Wilson's spiritual guide. I mean, it's where he went when he went looking for Ebby, and he met Sam, and they, in the early years, they went to the Oxford group, and Sam really had, matter of fact, Wilson actually went to him and asked him for help to write the big book, and he said, no, this is your gig, man. And he wrote this poem, and it's not about AA, but you tell me if this isn't your AA, and if it's not, you might want to look for it, because this exists. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they've not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door.
I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door, or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as not to hear them, and remember that they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them, but more important, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. For I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper, so I stand by the door. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, comments, bitches, complaints? Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, back there.
Oh, the flexible sobriety date? Casey's asking about what we feel about the flexible sobriety date. Well, when I came in, I'll speak to that just because in 1979 when I came in, I was horrified to find out that I had to quit doing drugs. It was just, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a drinking problem. And no, they said no. And what they explained to me after my first meeting, literally, the guys who were telling me about AA, they said that there were in California during the 60s meetings that were calling themselves in those days primary purpose meetings. And that people were just not drinking, but they could smoke the herb and they could drop a little acid. They could, you know, eat some Reds occasionally. Because it was just about not drinking. The thing was is that they couldn't not drink for a long period of time. They said that nobody could basically hang for more than 5 years or so without just needing to cut the cotton mouth a little bit. And so that's why all the way I've been very insistent about that it's no mind-altering stuff from the neck up as being the sobriety date. Now, as people grow in effectiveness and understanding, you know, that's fine. But there were people, there was a guy who was one of the, I don't know if any of the gangs here, remember Volleyball Ron? And he stood up, he was one of the icons at the Old Manhattan Beach Club. And he had 15 years of sobriety, and he stood up and gave back 10 years. It was one of those defining moments that helped really clean the consciousness of the area. Because, I mean, he was a well-known and well-respected member, and the girls loved him. And he said, I've been doing this, and I'm going to give back 10 years of my sobriety date, and he picked the date. So that's what I, you know, when it comes to mind-altering stuff.
The
you know,
drug bone is connected to the drink bone.
Correct. Yeah. There was another question, comment? Beautiful. Well, thank you very much.